This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. In this week's programme, we're asking what the EU and its member states want from Brexit and what would be their bottom line. Michel Barnier and his EU team truly do excel in being the most inflexible and arrogant bunch of people going. The EU is keener on revenge than a deal. You can't bully us, Mr. Barnier. There is a Europe imagined by sections of the popular press and some MPs, as reflected in the Brexit debate in Parliament on Tuesday.
The UK's approach is substantially more flexible and pragmatic than that of the EU.
Are the negotiations any more convivial than the press conferences that follow them?
When he next sits down with Michel Barnier, could my right honourable friend draw his attention to the fact that he's in dereliction of his duties under the treaty?
Does it follow that the European Commission demand for money with menaces is ridiculous? Yeah.
The EU has a very simple choice to make. I hope they make it sooner. They'll probably make it later. They can either trade with us with no new tariffs or barriers, because we've made a very generous offer, or they can trade with us under WTA rules, which we know works fine for us, because that's what we do with the rest of the world.
Yeah. Nobody's ever pretended this will be simple or easy. I've always said this.
But because this is a negotiation, understanding the views and needs of Europeans is essential for understanding the future.
Really, the only choice that Britain has is which set menu it wants. You can't, when you're faced with a set menu, choose a la carte. You cannot say, I want to substitute steak for the halibut. Sorry, it's not on. All you can possibly discuss, if you're lucky, is whether the steak will be rare or medium rare.
What do they want? Do they want the same thing? What would they settle for? And what are they expecting to happen? Step into the briefing room and find out. First, I want to understand more about the EU's institutional approach to the Brexit talks. I asked Adam Fleming, the BBC's Brussels reporter and presenter of the Brexitcast podcast, to explain.
Always go back to the documents. The advice given to me when I arrived in Brussels. So forget the leaks, the press conferences, and the off-the-record chats with foreign diplomats. I'm going to tell you about the 9-page paper that reveals exactly what the EU wants. It's called the European Council, brackets, Article 50, close brackets, Brexit Negotiation Guidelines. It was agreed on April the 29th by the European Council, which is made up of the EU leaders, corralled by the Council President, Donald Tusk.
We now have unanimous support from all the 27 member states and the EU institutions, giving us a strong political mandate for these negotiations.
A united front from the remaining members of the EU that splits the talks into two. The first, winding up the UK's membership in an orderly way. The second, looking to the future relationship with Britain. The guidelines were then handed to the EU's executive arm, the European Commission, which handles the talks day to day. Their frontman is the former French Foreign Minister and ex-European Commissioner, Michel Barnier.
We are entering uncharted waters. The work will be legally complex, politically sensitive, and will have important consequences for our economies and first for our people on both sides of the channel.
The document told him to focus on three priorities.
Citizens' rights.
What happens to EU nationals living in Britain after Brexit and British people living elsewhere? The EU wants European law to continue to apply directly in the UK in this area.
The single financial settlement.
We all know that one. It's agreeing a way of calculating the UK's remaining financial obligations. Not just the annual budget, but other programmes like aid to developing countries, loans made during the financial crisis, pensions for European officials. And
Ireland. The protection of the Good Friday Agreement and the maintenance of the common travel area.
Roughly, how do you manage what will be an external border of the EU in a way that doesn't jeopardise the Good Friday Peace Agreement? If EU leaders agree that so-called sufficient progress has been made in those areas, then talks can move on to the next phase, about the future. Here, our document of April the 29th is clear, but a bit less detailed. It proposes a free trade deal with the UK that's balanced, ambitious and wide-ranging. Their words. But there's a catch, as the Prime Minister of Malta, Joseph Muscat, explained earlier this year.
We want a fair deal for the United Kingdom, but that deal necessarily needs to be inferior to membership. This should not come as a surprise to anyone. Indeed, thinking it can be otherwise would indicate a detachment from reality.
The guidelines also demand a level playing field between the UK and the EU when it comes to tax and social and environmental regulations. And perhaps most importantly of all for the EU side, nothing can jeopardise the integrity of the single market or the laws that govern it. The document mentions a time-limited transition period and talks about the EU getting on with business as usual. Business that includes migration, relations with China and potential reforms to the Eurozone. Yes, some countries sell more cars to the UK, some send more migrants, some are more keen to get a move on and get talking about trade. But so far, the EU27 seem united, around their process and behind their chief negotiator, Mr. Barnier. The UK might not agree with everything, but it's all there in black and white and has been since the 29th of April. What the EU wants out of Brexit.
The BBC's Adam Fleming. So the 27 other members of the EU are seemingly united behind Michel Barnier when it comes to the current negotiation, which covers the divorce settlement, i.e. money, citizens and the Irish border. But will that hold true if and when they move on to discussing Britain's future trade relationship with the EU, the balanced, ambitious and wide-ranging deal that needs to be inferior to membership? I want to get a perspective on Brexit from different parts of the EU. Later, I'll hear from one of France's leading political figures, Pascal Lamy, former Director General of the World Trade Organization, EU Trade Commissioner, and close ally of the French President, Emmanuel Macron. But first, the view from Berlin. Daniela Schwarzer is the Director of the German Council on Foreign Relations, and she joined me in the briefing room earlier. I asked her whether there were significant gaps between the positions of the Commission and that of the German government.
On the questions that are high on the negotiation agenda, I do believe that the German government very much supports the Commission's approach. And, you know, one of the priorities, if you ask German policymakers today, it's not really Brexit, it's really keeping the EU together. To make sure that the other EU countries actually stay where they are, meaning in the EU, and that the EU as such isn't weakened by Brexit, but actually grows stronger as negotiations are going ahead. One of the fears is that a Brexit, which, you know, looks just too easy and too beneficial for the country that's leaving, in this case the UK, that this could create copycat effects and that other countries then say, well, maybe this is just the right option for us as well.
So tell me, what, if you look forward, would Germany, the German government, the German political establishment, want to see optimally out of the process of Brexit? What would the best possible Brexit that Germany could aim for look like?
Well, first of all, quick and smooth negotiations on the divorce. there's big concern in Berlin that the time frame is just very tight. So there's a hope that some good deal is struck and that we don't have a messy Brexit without a deal. That's the first thing. Then on substance, obviously, there's the question of the Brexit bill. I mean, there's no intent whatsoever to make any profit from Brexit, but to have a fair settlement that looks good to all sides and is not to the disadvantage of any side. Then on the free movement of people, you know, Germans want a fair treatment, obviously, like all other countries, of those citizens that live in the UK and are willing to give the same to British citizens. But for Germany, the free movement of people within the EU and within any possible future arrangement with the UK would be something they would wish for. But that seems to be the point where the British government is not sort of the same opinion. And then, you know, once the divorce is negotiated, I think the Germans will want to very quickly turn to the question of how can we maintain the benefits of the single market, even though the UK will formally leave it. So, you know, Germany wants to export to the UK. It wants, obviously, British imports to Germany. It wants close investment relationships and so on. So the economic agenda is of high importance.
What is Germany pricing in, if you understand? What I mean by that is, you've seen how the negotiations have gone so far. You've seen how the political argument has developed in Britain. You've got your optimal position, what you would most like to happen. What are you actually expecting to happen?
I think that the trade deal may be more difficult to achieve than people would hope for. So that it will take longer, first of all, so there will be some transitionary agreements, but that at some point we will have to realize that it wasn't possible to fully negotiate a setup which is pretty, in substance, pretty similar to the single market, meaning like free flow of capital, of people, of goods, no border taxes, no border controls and all that. So I think the reality after this transitionary period will be somewhat different. And here's obviously the question, for instance, for German car manufacturers, will we be able to export as we do today? How high will the import taxes be? Will we still remain competitive in the British market? The degree of uncertainty is very high at this point. Some companies or banks have clearly made the choice to move early and have already announced that they are planning to relocate partially, at least to continental Europe. Others are waiting, but I think the window for this decision is basically only up to next summer. So within a year from now, I think companies at the latest will need certainty, because if Brexit becomes effective in spring 2019, corporate decisions need to be implemented before that. So I think, you know, this uncertainty is really something that plays, and it definitely holds back investment and weighs on business decisions that have to be taken by the day.
Daniela Schwarzer there with the view from arguably the EU's most powerful nation. But is it one shared by countries which wield less influence? Poland joined the EU in 2004, but has become an important voice in what's known as the Visegrad Group of Central European states. Poland also has a particular interest in Brexit because more than 800,000 Poles are estimated to live in Britain. I asked Jacek Rostowski, Poland's former Minister of Finance, to brief me on the Visegrad perspective.
There are common interests. A very important common interest is the money. Because if Britain falls out and doesn't supply the money, then all the rest have to renegotiate the seven-year EU budget, or what's left of it, through to 2023, in fact, all over again. And that's something very inconvenient. So this is just about the only bargaining chip that the British have. Certainly buying Prosecco from the Italians and Camembert from the French is not a strong bargaining chip. So the Visegrad countries are interested in the money. They're also interested, of course, in the position of their own nationals in the UK. But of course, the UK should also be interested in that. We know there's a shortage of about 60,000 construction workers in the southeast of England. There will be huge shortages in nursing staff in the NHS. That's mostly actually not people from Visegrad, but from Spain, Portugal, and to some extent Italy.
What does Poland want optimally out of the process? What does it want at the end of Brexit, if it can get it?
First of all, going back to the money, it was Poland that pushed for adding the question of agricultural subsidies to what Britain would be expected to pay through to 2023, together with France. So although there was a lot of cozying up between the current Polish government and the British government, when it actually came down to crafting the position, Poland was a pretty hard line. I think Poland doesn't have particular strategic objectives in this. It obviously wants to maintain good relations with Britain in the defence sphere, but we should also not overstate that.
There's speculation here in Britain that might be possible to separate some EU countries from the negotiating position of the European Union itself. Do you think that's either possible or desirable?
It's actually very difficult for a country that wanted to influence the negotiations in Britain's favour to achieve that even on its own account. So what you're actually more likely to do if you split the EU is entrench positions between two or three or maybe even more groups of EU countries which will mutually stymie each other and make a cliff-edge Brexit more likely. You know, we understand that as Poles a little bit better because we went through the accession negotiations. Those were deeply humiliating, and one of the reasons they were deeply humiliating because they were basically on a take-it-or-leave-it basis. And the reason they were on a take-it-or-leave-it basis was that they were happening after the existing members had already agreed a position, and they really found it almost impossible to change that position.
We've heard about how in the trade negotiations, the question of the future relationship on trade depends from the European perspective on the four freedoms, not least freedom of movement. Is that also the case for Poland?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, Poland would never agree to give Britain effective full access or membership of the single market, or really very wide access to the single market without freedom of movement. And actually, neither would Germany nor France nor anybody else. The British side keeps thinking that they can find things that are almost exactly like EU membership without having to bear the costs. And this has been, you know, repeated again and again, no cherry picking. And one of the reasons that nobody will agree to cherry picking by the British is that then everybody else within the EU would probably want to cherry pick. The EU has built up sort of packages. There's European Economic Area membership, there's the EU Customs Union, there are various forms of treaty with the EU, and those are sort of ready packages. They're set menus. And really, the only choice that Britain has is which set menu it wants. You can't, when you're faced with a set menu, choose a la carte. You cannot say, I want to substitute steak for the halibut. Sorry, it's not on. All you can possibly discuss, if you're lucky, is whether the steak will be rare or medium rare.
So what do you think that the long-term outcome of the Brexit negotiations are going to be?
What I expect is that the government will settle for an extension of the status quo, including free movement of labour, for another 3 years, so as to have the real Brexit with all its implications, with all its downsides, which will then be apparent. I would expect that sort of standstill outcome to be agreed for a period of at least three years beyond Brexit.
Jacek Rostowski. There's been lots of speculation over the past year about France's view of Brexit. This week, the City of London's representative to the EU, Jeremy Brown, said France sees Brexit as an opportunity to reshape the bloc in a manner that suits its interests. So what does France really think? And how does that fit in with the Brussels position? If anyone should know the answers, it's my next guest. Pascal Lamy has known French President Emmanuel Macron for over a decade. He was Director General of the World Trade Organization, and before that, he was the EU's Trade Commissioner. He spoke to me from the south of France.
First, the French government, the French authorities, the French president believes Brexit is a bad thing for everybody, because the cost of removing the UK egg from the EU omelette will be significant. Most of the cost, according to the French view, will be for the Brits, but there is a cost for us also. So it's seen as a sort of damage-limiting exercise, and we are trying to limit this damage. That's the overall stance. Nothing to do, you know, with some sort of resentment, punishment, not at all. The basic feeling is sorry. That's what they said they would do. Let's now cook it in such a way that it is as digestible as possible, knowing that it's going to be very difficult to make this digestible on both sides.
At the beginning, the idea was to create, as we've heard, a balanced, ambitious and wide-ranging trade agreement for Britain post-Brexit, but at the same time that it had to be inferior to the position that Britain enjoyed as a member of the EU. That's a very tricky balance, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Leaving the internal market means that there will be frictions to trade which were not there before. Borders, controls, checks, access problems depending on a number of issues, whether there are or not tariffs. So it's going to be very complex. Nothing, of course, is as good as being a member of the internal market, which is, by the way, one of the reasons why the Brits in the 80s pushed, and I remember that very well when I was a chief of staff of Jacques Delors, because it was a good economic deal, which I think remains true. So removing this, again, the egg from the omelette will have a cost. My guess is that we will have to land to something which is extremely open, being understood that the United Kingdom becomes a third country, which will not prevent anyhow from having new controls, new borders, hence new costs. So there will be an impact on trade. Again, I think the name of the game is let's make this impact as modest as possible for both sides.
So in other words, the French view is that Britain is bound to lose out by leaving the EU.
No doubt about that.
Yes, so you don't have to do anything yourselves. The EU doesn't have to do anything itself to make that outcome worse. It's already going to be as bad as it's going to be.
I think it's a good way of putting it since on the French side, yeah.
So what would be the French bottom line? Are there any outcomes that that France would not be willing to accept in terms of a deal with Britain?
The red lines are there from the very beginning. And the basic red line is that you cannot separate within the internal market free circulation of people, of goods, of services, and of capital. These four freedoms are totally interconnected and you cannot separate them. For instance, getting rid of freedom of movement for people and keeping freedom of movement for goods, capital or services. And it's not a question of theory, it's a question of experience. That's the basic red line. The rest, I think, is perfectly negotiable as long as, notably on the trade side, the Brits will accept the EU trade regime. As long as the Brits respect the EU standard, like the Norwegians do, like the Swiss do, fine with opening trade. But it means that you have to respect a standard which is decided elsewhere, which, by the way, doesn't look like a big gain of sovereignty, if you allow this opinion.
What is the French government and the French political establishment expecting? Not what does it want, not what is its bottom line, what is it actually expecting to happen out of these negotiations? In other words, what's its calculation, not just about itself, but about Britain?
I think the view in Paris, which I guess is not different from the view in other European capitals, is that it's going to be messy, nasty, longer than expected. It's a bad thing which they have to manage, and it will probably land into a separation in 2019. But then there will be a long period of transition in order to adjust many of these details, whether it's about road haulage or airline slots, not to speak about fishing rights, which are things which are extremely complex to disentangle. They were complex to entangle. It took many years to get to a full-fledged internal market. If the effort to create the internal market is one, the effort to remove a country from the internal market is probably five. And this proportion I know for sure, because I was an expert of this thing for many years, this proportion everybody needs to have in mind.
Of course, one possibility is that you won't get an outcome. In other words, there will be the famous crash out of the EU by Britain. Seriously, when you discuss these things, you know, over dinner tables and so on in France, are you allowing for such a possibility?
Yes, it's one of the scenarios, and it's the most costly for everybody, which is why, if people have to choose, they will put this scenario at the bottom of the list.
What about domestic French politics in the sense of the pressure that there might be felt by Emmanuel Macron to show to the French that there, and potential supporters of the Front National, that there is a big cost for leaving the EU?
I think you're right, but this does not need to be engineered. This is the reality. And all European governments have the view that it's a costly operation, and this diagnosis can be shared by other than the parties that are in government. No doubt about that. But if the interesting development, which is that within the EU 27, including France, support for European integration has gone up very significantly since June last year. So Brexit has triggered a sort of pro-European reaction within public opinions. As we all know, support for European integration has been dwindling for the last 10 years, notably because of the economic crisis. And there's a bump that starts summer last year. But that's a political reality, which is an important development because it might allow the European Union to open a new phase of integration.
So Brexit won't reshape Europe, it will solidify Europe.
That's what we read in polls at this time. Now, whether this political energy will be translated into political action remains to be seen. But the view of the French president, which I happen to know, both the president and the view, his view is EU minus UK is losing weight, roughly 15% economic weight, 25% political weight. So we lose weight, we should compensate this by winning muscle. Can we win muscles in being stronger, i.e. more integrated in some areas?
Pascal Lamy. So to sum up, while it suits their interest to ensure Britain remains a strong trading partner and ally, European countries don't particularly want to create an advertisement for leaving the club. And although trade with Britain will be very important, nothing is more important than preserving the integrity of the single market. My thanks to Adam Fleming, Daniela Schwarzer, Jacek Rostowski and Pascal Lamy. We'll be back at the same time next week. Good night. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by China Collins and Javier Zapata. If you enjoyed this week's Briefing Room and you're looking for other podcasts on all things Brexit, then do try Brexit Cast, presented by Chris Mason and Adam Fleming, who you heard earlier. And please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So, if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.